Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Today we'll hear more about the housing difficulties in the Northwest with a special feature by Ruby DeLuna. Station manager Joanne Rideout has our top story with a report from a very special emergency training session held last week in Kathlamet. This is The Bridge for the week of September 2nd. Last Friday, law enforcement officers and other first responders gathered at Kathlamet High School for an emergency response drill organized by Wakayakum County. They were practicing for something awful they hope will never happen, an active shooter in the school. Joanne Rideout has the story.
Most of us don't really think much about this. What would happen if there was suddenly an active shooter inside a local high school, firing weapons, detonating bombs, causing a massive emergency response effort to spring into action? On a sunny, warm day on the school campus, this was no tabletop exercise. Volunteers arrived early to be made up as injured victims. Officers gathered to participate in this day-long, full-scale emergency response training. Wakayakum County Sheriff Mark Howey.
The attackers that hit our schools are in rural counties, in rural areas. They're not in big cities, New York, Seattle, LA. You hear about it in the fringes of communities. Responders are usually single responders. We don't have time to wait now these days for a backup. If somebody's actively hurting our kids and our staff, we're going in to stop the threat.
Inside a classroom, makeup artists used adhesive plastic wounds and stage makeup to create burn injuries, gunshot entry and exit wounds, and broken bones on locals who answered the call for people to act as victims. The technique is called moulage.
So these are pre-made, and oftentimes they have them in latex, but these ones are actually so that people, if they have a latex allergy, that they won't have an allergic reaction. So what you do with the pre-made ones is you put down an adhesive, and sometimes, I'm used to working with spirit gum, but we have a different adhesive here, and then you put that on there, slap that on, let it dry, put some setting powder, and then you can start putting the blood and gore on it.
By early afternoon, participants were ready to go. From the press area behind the school where the media was sequestered, we experienced this event the way any citizen might who has a police scanner. We heard it on the radio.
1-3, I got one gunman in the cafeteria, one victim at this point alive in the cafeteria. I'm holding my position.
We've all seen emergencies depicted in TV shows and movies. They're scenes of high drama with fast-moving police vehicles, sirens, flashing lights. But in this active shooter situation, law enforcement officers moved cautiously and quietly. Police cruisers pulled up in front of the high school without a sound as officers silently accessed the premises. The effect was chilling as we heard the drill unfold.
1-3, Kathlamet. I only got one shooter on my side of the building. I cleared the first hallway.
1-3, can you hear any other gunfire in the area?
Okay. Negative, Kathlamet. I'm losing a lot of blood.
As officers subdued the suspect and located mock bombs, emergency responders gathered behind the high school to minister to the injured. This drill was meant as a training for first responders. Sheriff Howey said the lessons for ordinary citizens caught in a situation like this are different.
Run, hide, fight. Simple as that. Run away from the threat. If you hear it over here, you run that way. You get out as soon as you can, exit as far as you can, as quickly as you can. If you can't and you're in lockdown or you have to stay in one area, you hide, and you hide as well as you can, and you fortify as well as you can. And then thirdly, if that person's making their way to you, no matter what, you get anything you can in your realm to fight the person.
According to FEMA, in the past 7 years, there's been an average of 16 active shooter incidents annually in the U.S. Active shooter incidents tend to occur most often in commerce areas and in educational institutions. From Kathlamet, Washington, I'm Joanne Rideout reporting.
Correspondent Karen Richards looks at how the Every Student Succeeds Act may affect Oregon teachers. It only takes a moment to sign major bills into law. It will take years to implement a new federal education policy.
Classes won't start for a couple weeks, but the McKenzie High School football team has practice, and it's day one for administrators across the state.
I'm Lane Tompkins. I'm the K-12 principal of McKenzie Schools. I'm a graduate from the class of 2000, and then my mom was a 1972 graduate.
This is Tompkins' third year as principal. The school up the McKenzie River east of Eugene is 75 years old and has plenty of extra room. Like many Oregon timber communities, droves of families moved out in the 80s and 90s as lumber jobs disappeared. Now there are around 180 students across 12 grades. Tompkins says one of the biggest challenges of the No Child Left Behind Act was hiring staff to meet its standards.
We're so small that an example was for science. It's really hard to find somebody to be our science department because it's not just a general science endorsement.
Under NCLB, Tompkins needed one teacher, highly qualified and endorsed in biology, chemistry, and physical science. Help may be on the way. President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, last December. It requires the states to craft their own rules.
The biggest transition is the elimination of the highly qualified requirements.
Tim Boyd works on school effectiveness at the Oregon Department of Education. He says the state is working hard to make a plan for teacher qualifications that works for small communities like McKenzie, as well as big city districts. The ODE held public meetings last spring and summer asking what makes an ideal school. This fall, they're analyzing the feedback. Derek Brown's focus is on assessment and accountability. He says people were strongly against having summative or broad year-end assessments, like the Smarter Balance test, factor into teacher evaluations, as is the current policy.
The recommendations coming out of the work groups and some of the other themes that we've heard from the forums are moving that from a shall to a may. That it wouldn't be required, but it would be optional.
We know that there is no research that shows that summative assessments being used to evaluate teachers is an effective way to do so.
Hannah Vandering is president of the Oregon Education Association, the state's largest teachers union. She points to Senate Bill 290 as a model. The 2011 state law requires multiple measures of teacher evaluation, including student assessments. However, those assessments may include classwork or data other than standardized tests. Principal Tompkins has been happy with SB 290, which remains in effect. It's required him to check in on his staff more often.
Now we're mandated to do the things that good administrators and teachers should be doing, meeting and talking. Most of the time, those conversations are a lot of fun.
He says it's rewarding to review student progress throughout the year, yet it's sometimes hard to keep up with the ever-changing requirements and paperwork landing on his desk.
One of the things that with education that can get frustrating is we try something for a while, and then 4 or 5 years in, we're, no, let's go do something totally different. We're not actually able to see how it plays out long term.
Rolling out new rules can take years. This fall, the feds will continue to tweak last year's law. Oregon won't submit its plan until spring. Implementation begins next school year. Tompkins isn't waiting to see if ESSA will give his district more flexibility in hiring.
We'll be presenting our proposal for our charter at this next board meeting. So I think going charter would really open us up to be able to offer more things to our students.
He says being a charter school would also enable them to bring in students from outside district boundaries. It might even encourage more people to move to the community. Leif Gustafson is dean of the College of Education at Pacific University. He feels it's important to create a sustainable teaching workforce.
We can't look at public education like a business. It requires different ways of thinking. It is an essential fabric within our society that does not bend and shift with the whims of the economy.
Gustafson thinks this transition time offers an opportunity if all stakeholders, including Oregon's teacher prep programs, are included in the conversation.
I really feel like we can do this and we could be a model for the country.
OEA's Hannah Vandering shares his enthusiasm.
We have underfunded public education in Oregon for far too long, but we have the opportunity right now of a lifetime.
Derek Brown at ODE agrees the state's collaboration with unions, teachers, and parents is unique. He says it's hard work, but it's the right work. For Oregon schools and classrooms, the fruits of that labor can't come soon enough. Karen Richards, KLCC News. ¶¶
You're listening to The Bridge. In the next half, we'll look at welfare reform, a new way to think about homelessness, and the ever-tightening housing crunch here in the Northwest. A landmark welfare reform bill turned 20 years old last week. It was meant to overhaul the way government cash assistance is distributed. The reforms gave states a lot of flexibility in the way they hand out money, and some states have been more successful than others when it comes to helping the poor. Chris Lehman reports that Oregon is one of the places that's done the best job.
A big goal in Amber Lakin's life is to ring this bell someday. The bell is in the lobby of a nonprofit called Central City Concern in Portland. It means that someone has found permanent employment. Lakin is working toward that goal in an office just behind that lobby. She helps fill orders and arrange deliveries for the organization's coffee roasting business.
I definitely make more than my food stamps and my TANF combined.
TANF is what welfare is called now. It stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. The program where Lakin works is a way for people like her to learn basic office skills with the goal of eventually landing a full-time job. The training and the paycheck she's getting here is part of Oregon's plan to help welfare recipients become self-sufficient. It's a dramatic turnaround for the 28-year-old.
I didn't have a dollar to my name.
Lakin says a few years ago she was addicted to meth and trapped in an abusive relationship.
He controlled everything that I had, how I had it, how much I had, and I had exhausted every single resource as far as like friends and family to be able to help me, and it got to the point that they wouldn't help me anymore.
Lakin got into a drug treatment program. She also applied for TANF, and she says that gave her the financial independence she needed to break free from the abusive partner.
And it was able to then help pay for my rent. It was able to help pay for, like, my transportation.
Lakin credits her case manager with the Oregon Department of Human Services for helping to bring some order to her chaotic life. The agency's Kim Fredland says developing a meaningful relationship with TANF recipients is one of the program's goals. In fact, the state is no longer calling them case managers. The new job title is family coach.
A coach's role is really about encouragement. It's about helping to challenge someone when they're struggling with something, teaching them, and really helping them move forward.
And Fredland says that Oregon is trying to run the program more like a for-profit business. Case in point, virtually everyone who walks in the door is helped in 30 minutes or less.
We are delivering a service to them. It's not pizza. It's a much more important service, but we do deliver a service that, you know, can impact people's lives pretty dramatically.
Fredland says the change even extends to the physical appearance of field offices.
When I first started with the department 25 years ago, you would walk in and they had the bulletproof glass and the little round circle where you would talk to the receptionist.
Now the lobbies have a more open floor plan and better lighting. The agency's commitment to the program is backed up by state lawmakers. Last year, the Oregon legislature used savings from the drop in caseloads following the recession to raise income thresholds and allow more people to stay on longer.
It's not as bad here as some other states, but we still have a stubborn poverty rate.
Chuck Sheketoff is head of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, a left-leaning think tank in Portland. The state's poverty rate is right around the national average, but nearly half of its families with children in poverty receive TANF benefits. That's well above the national average, and one of the main reasons Oregon's venture into welfare reform is considered successful. Still, Sheketoff thinks the state should make it easier for people to get on the program, but he gives the state credit for at least preserving the basic concepts behind welfare.
Clinton said he was going to end welfare as we know it, and some states just ended welfare. And that was wrong, and that was heartless.
Nationally, there are about 4.1 million people on federally funded cash assistance programs. But Kathy Eden, a poverty expert at Johns Hopkins University, says that number doesn't tell the whole story.
Half of those are in just two states, California and New York, meaning that in many states across the United States, there is virtually no welfare system at all.
But that's certainly not the case in Oregon, where about 54,000 adults and children live in households receiving TANF benefits. And for recipients who take part in the state's job training program, a high percentage are able to move off TANF altogether.
Hey, you. How
are you? Good. People like Amber Lakin, for whom the welfare system was key to getting her back in the workforce. It also gave her the stability she needed to regain custody of her son, who's getting ready to enter kindergarten this fall.
You know, like my son today tells me like I'm a good mom and that, you know, he loves me and that I'm so pretty, or, you know, he just tells me all these things. And especially a child that's been in and out of foster care, it's hard to imagine that they would ever feel that way about me.
And Lakin says for her, that's the biggest victory of all. I'm Chris Lehman in Portland.
A new state-sponsored retirement plan for private sector workers in Oregon has cleared a key federal hurdle. The U.S. Department of Labor finalized rules that allow Oregon's plan to debut next July. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman has more.
The plan will allow workers without employer-sponsored retirement accounts to enroll in one created by the state. The Oregon Department of Treasury estimates that about half of all Oregon workers currently don't have access to such a plan. It would work much like a 401k, with money deducted from a worker's paycheck. The new rule from the Obama administration clarifies that state-sponsored retirement plans are allowed under federal law. The announcement clears the way for Oregon and seven other states to launch their plans. Oregon's version was narrowly approved last year by state lawmakers. I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
Now we have a straightforward question with a very complicated answer. Question: why not start by giving homeless people a place to live? Seattle was one of the cities in the Northwest that pioneered a strategy to fight homelessness called Housing First. That means getting people into housing before their sober or their mental illness had stabilized. The most famous example was housing for chronic inebriates that opened in 2005. Letting alcoholics drink in their rooms was controversial at the time. Housing First is now a broadly accepted strategy. Washington State has built a lot of housing on this model. Growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols explains how it works.
Rob Gilroy had a wife, kids, and a good job as a garbage collector. Then a divorce kicked his butt.
I was grieving, and so I unfortunately turned to drugs. The bottom line when it comes to drugs is, you know, you're going to end up with nothing.
Days added up to weeks, which added up to years. Gilroy became what you'd call chronically homeless.
Getting housing, it seems so out of reach, because you'll hear these stories of people saying, oh my gosh, I've been on the waiting list for 8 years, you know, and I still haven't got my housing. And so it seems so far away.
Gilroy says the shelters he stayed in never tried to convince him otherwise. But then he came to the Blaine Center, a homeless shelter near the Space Needle. They follow a Housing First model. That means they try to get you out of the shelter and into permanent housing first, before you've resolved your addiction issues or mental illness issues or whatever. The idea is that once people get into housing, they're more receptive to treatment. Gilroy's case manager at the shelter was Juanita Unger. She says Housing First works, but there aren't enough places to put people.
How often do you fail to find a place to put somebody?
Often.
So it was a big deal when Unger found Gilroy an apartment in a special building for people like him in the Inner Bay neighborhood. Still, when Unger told Gilroy about the apartment, he balked.
He was pretty apprehensive.
Unger told him, you need to take this apartment. There are probably 100 people waiting for your shelter bed, people who need a little bit of help so they can bounce back. Unger told Gilroy, you may not stay in our shelter forever.
That's a hard conversation to have with people, and he did not like it either. He was pretty angry at me. you know, there's kind of a risk. You know, could this push him over the edge where he doesn't accept the housing and he goes into a loop of whatever, you know, depression or addiction or whatever.
Gilroy took the tiny studio apartment. 6 months later, he's still getting used to it. Security here is tight. Not just anyone can drop in and visit him. And then there's the constant reminders of addiction. When the guy down the hall is coming down from a high, he yells a lot. Gilroy is trying to make it feel like home. He's really proud of a beautiful white couch where he sleeps.
I just got this furniture for $50 from some guy. It was a really good deal. I used to have a bed, but I'd rather have it set like a living room. It's more comfortable for me.
He's using a lot less meth than he used to. He says someday he hopes to kick it altogether. Get a job driving a garbage truck or a metro bus. He's got a caseworker from the Downtown Emergency Service Center to help him out. And you could say he started on a new leg of his journey.
That's what this building and DESC has kind of helped me do is get my independence back, get my self-worth back.
So what lies at the end of that journey? Sandra Andrews of Federal Way can tell you. She's enjoying a celebratory meal with a couple of social workers. She got to choose the restaurant. She chose Denny's. She's about to dig into her favorite meal.
Oh, biscuits and gravy are my favorites. Every time I go to a restaurant, I like biscuits and gravy.
And also some strawberry pancakes. Andrews is graduating from a housing program kind of like the one Rob Gilroy just got into. Her apartment will be signed over to her name. She'll be independent.
You could come back, too, and do a talk to people that are interested in graduating but afraid.
Uh-huh.
You know? You could.
Long ago, Andrews was living in a boat in her brother's backyard, hooked on heroin, struggling with mental illness, and making money as a prostitute. She ended up at Western State Hospital and then got into low-barrier housing through a nonprofit called Navos. That helped her transition to a life where she can take care of herself. She's clean and sober now. She's been applying for jobs recently. No bites yet, but she's hopeful, and her peers are noticing her success.
Makes me feel really good. I've never, you know, been a role model before in my life, you know, but I've changed a lot.
This is how Housing First works.
It's an incredibly successful intervention as far as the stability it provides.
That's Laura Machu from New York. She runs the Supportive Housing Network of New York. That's a group that includes 200 nonprofit housing and service providers. Her state has built more low-barrier apartments per capita than any other state. It began in the mid-1990s. Since then, New York has cut its population of chronically homeless single adults by half. In other words, it's been a long slog. But Michu says it's worth it because it saves taxpayers money.
You know, someone who's homeless is cycling in and out of shelter, emergency rooms, prisons, state psych beds, and those systems are incredibly expensive.
New York State has built over 28,000 low-barrier apartments for single adults. Washington State has built around 7,000. That's more than a lot of states, but it might not be enough. And as rents continue to rise, it's possible the number of people pushed into homelessness could outstrip whatever additional housing supply we manage to build. But like Rob Gilroy and Sandra Andrews, we've got to start somewhere. In Seattle, I'm Joshua McNichols.
Seattle's new director of homelessness started his job last week. George Scarola is the city's first cabinet-level director in charge of efforts to address Seattle's homelessness crisis. Scarola says it's an issue that touches many people, and that includes him.
We have good family friends whose son just decided that he was going to live in his car because he can't afford an apartment, much to his parents' consternation. Every family, almost every family, has somebody who's living at the margins, who may have a mental health or an emotional issue or an addiction issue. Some families have the ability to help that person through that crisis. Some families don't.
Scarola says there are already plenty of city, county, and nonprofit experts working on the issue. He says it's important to get more efficient with homelessness resources in order to move people out of dangerous situations and into stable housing. Scarola previously worked as the legislative director for the League of Education Voters. We've been taking a look at the Northwest housing market and attempts to make it easier for residents to find homes. Seniors are feeling the squeeze of Seattle's heated housing market. Ruby DeLuna brings us the story of one Seattle man who was displaced as a result.
It's Wednesday morning. Bill Totten is checking in at the Hygiene Center in Seattle's Pioneer Square. He hands his laundry card to the staff.
Thank you, dear.
You all do laundry and shower?
No shower, just laundry.
Once he's signed in, Totten puts his clothes on a scale to weigh them before they go in the washer.
Now we get to see if we made the magic 15 pounds. It's like the county fair. I did. I'm 3 pounds under. I am so good.
Another staff person directs Totten to a machine that's open. He loads the washer.
You drop your clothes off, and then by the end of the day, you have to pick them up.
Bill Totten is 61 years old and on disability. He's been homeless since May. He spends his nights at a shelter for homeless men over 50. Before that, Totten was renting a room in the basement of a house that was in disrepair. A crumbling foundation, no heat.
I was paying $650 plus $100 for utilities, and here's the deal, the basement, there was an illegal subdivide.
The landlord was also renting out to other people beyond the house's capacity. The building was unsafe on another level. One of the tenants assaulted him over an electric bill.
I was really tapped out. I was glad to have a place. I thought maybe it was just an aberration at that one time. And then it happened again.
Things got complicated. The landlord tried to evict him twice. The landlord wanted a new rental agreement. Totten withheld rent because the unit was in bad shape. Totten said the situation was wearing him down, so he got out. Seattle's housing market is not only pricing renters out, it's also causing people like Totten to live in substandard conditions because it's what they can afford. Older adults may be vulnerable to offers of illegal housing. Some landlords have rented out garages as homes.
We've seen that. We've seen sheds.
Rory O'Sullivan is senior managing attorney for the Housing Justice Project. The legal clinic helps low-income folks facing eviction. O'Sullivan says more tenants have been seeking help in the last 4 years, including people over 60.
This year, the increase has been even more dramatic.
In previous years, seniors make up about 13% of the legal clinic's caseload. Now, it's closer to 20%. Other organizations that work with renters also report a spike in complaints. O'Sullivan says in Seattle, landlords must give tenants 2 months' notice if they're going to raise the rent by more than 10%. Tenants, especially older ones, can protect themselves, first by knowing their rights as early as possible. The lease is a good place to start. It spells out the obligations of landlords and renters when it comes to things like repairs, security deposit, and maintenance.
Try to document everything. Make sure you get a receipt every time you pay rent. When you make a repair request, make sure that it's in writing and that you have a record of it. But we see these issues every day, and the tenants who are able to negotiate a good outcome are the tenants who have read their lease and documented their communications with the landlord.
Thank you.
Back at the Hygiene Center, Bill Totten's laundry is done. He spends his days walking or online looking for work to supplement his Social Security. Some days, he likes to take a break from it all.
Once in a while, I'll do something just like go up to the main office of my bank, Wells Fargo, and, oh, Mr. Totten, how are you? Have a dum-dum. And, you know, I don't feel like I'm walking around with the Orange Harbor View bag on 3rd Avenue.
It helps keep his sense of humor in perspective. He has stored his belongings at a friend's house while he looks for a permanent home, but the options for someone on Social Security are limited. He has about $1,700 a month to work with.
And then that has to keep my medical co-payments, my prescription co-payments, my bus pass, any incidentals.
Totten says he might have to consider other cities like Everett or Tacoma, though he hears the average rents there are going up too. And in his heart, Seattle is home.
My city's my family.
He's been working with a social worker to get connected to services and keeping his ears open for leads. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.